This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
Us this myth that how the market will self-regulate, but elite business schemes would still just be dreams without the arms of the state. If you want to know what they mean when they say we're going to open up your markets for our free trade, just ask the ghosts of all those who've been killed for refusing to bow down before the dollar bill. One of two, wielded by the corporate elite and dressed in red, white, and blue. In one fist, an M16 rifle, in the other one, $1,000 bill. The right fist doesn't get you, then the other one surely. So Merck or Union Carbide, they go by so many names. For the land and the people destroyed by their greed, the story is always the same. McDonald's required McDonnell Douglas, United Fruit needed U.S. Marines. The freedom of their market, controlled by fascist regimes. The invisible hand of the market is only one of two, wielded by the corporate elite and dressed in red, white, and blue. In one fist an M16 rifle, in the other one $1,000 bill. The right fist doesn't get you, then the other one. Choose our own destinies. It's freedom to choose our demise. You can die for their money. You can die by their guns. They'll let you choose your own fate. If you get in the way of their profit, you can be sure you'll be burnt at the stake. The invisible hand of the market is only one of two, wielded by the corporate elite and dressed in red, white, and blue. In one fist an M16 rifle, in the other one $1,000 bill. The right fist doesn't get you, then the other one. Soldiers in olive drab marching on by. discipline, liberalize, legislate, regulate, we decline. Without you, we were just doing fine. The invisible hand on the market is only one of two. Wielded by the corporate elite and dressed in red, white, and blue. And one piston and 16 rifle, and the other one a $1,000 bill. The right fist doesn't get you, then the other one.
Last week, I began reading from the book For Giving by the feminist philosopher Genevieve Vaughn. It's a critique of the exchange economy, the economy of money and prices, where the things of nature and the efforts of people are reduced to commodities and assigned a monetary value. Vaughn says that the market, which some people insist is the epitome of freedom, in fact, often promotes the benefit of a few while claiming to be good for everyone. It's a product of patriarchy, which Vaughn said has infected women and men for centuries, distorting our view of the world and warping our socioeconomic practices. In contrast, she said, the agenda of feminism is to liberate everyone, women, children, and men, from patriarchy, without destroying the human beings who are its carriers and the planet where they live. I'll resume reading in Chapter 1, where Vaughn has begun by asking what it means to think outside patriarchy. She writes, "Whenever we're talking about the human condition, we should subject our own discourse to at least two tests. What's in it for me materially, and secondly, what's in it for me psychologically?" Criticism of ideology has shown that whole systems of thought have served the dominance of some groups over others. Every academic discipline should be suspect. Systems of ideas, which we have been taught as the truth, back up the political and economic systems of which they are a part. Fortunately, I have been outside the academic world and not dependent upon it for my material well-being. Thus, I have been able to remain naive. I desire radical social change. As a mother, I want my children and the children of all mothers to receive a healthy and sane future, free from the collective psychosis of patriarchy. Contributing effectively to this future is my psychological reward. I hope to show that there is a feminist explanation for language, and that much of our thinking can be reframed as deriving from a woman-based practice. There is an entirely different paradigm which exists and is accessible beneath the abstractions of linguistics and semiotics. Feminists who have been rightly distressed by the male dominance of language have sometimes chosen to speak and write poetically as an alternative. They have even sometimes chosen to remain silent in order to subtract themselves from patriarchal discourse. I suggest that by finding and consciously embracing the hidden paradigm, we can begin to liberate both language and social practice from patriarchal control. In spite of endless discussions, philosophers have not been able to answer the question, how are words hooked on to the world? This question is the end of a thread which is bound up in a tangle of patriarchal philosophy, a good place to begin a naive investigation. All the answers that have been given to this question have been influenced by the patriarchal stances of the mostly male philosophers who were doing the thinking. Their points of view grew up in denial of a woman's model and have served to support patriarchal hierarchies throughout the centuries. I do not want to try to refute current or past theories of language one by one, which would make this book an endless academic undertaking conducted on the territory of those I want to challenge. I will simply propose an alternative theory. Let me identify some questions that need to be answered. We need to know how words, phrases, discourses mean. How are they related to each other and to the world? What is the significance of language for the nature of human beings as individuals and as a species? Why is it important for us to know this? Since language has been considered to play an important role in making us human, answering these questions in terms of an abstract system causes us to attribute our humanity to our capacity for abstract thought, with the consequence that those of us who are best at abstract thinking appear to be somehow more human than the others. Women have been stereotypically assigned the province of emotion, while men have appropriated the area of reason. If we see language as an abstract system having the capacity to make us human, men's, quote, superiority would seem to be justified by their presumed capacity for abstraction. Theories of language back up theories, or at least popular conceptions, of gender. At another level of complication, considering syntax as a collection of rules imputes the rule-governed character of the human being as well. Thus, it validates our system of laws, making them seem natural because they are also collections of rules and require rule-governed activity. What happens in academia regarding language can have far-reaching effects on the rest of the world. Academic economic theories also have important effects on the way goods are produced and distributed everywhere. Even when the effects are not direct, the assumptions underlying these disciplines influence individual and group behavior in many areas of life. Changing the basic assumptions would have a far-reaching ripple effect. They form the motivation and backup rationale for policies and behaviors in much the same way that the existence of the military-industrial complex forms the motivation and backup for U.S. foreign policy. Co-creation of patriarchy. It has become commonplace in the U.S. New Age movement to talk about the co-creation of, quote, reality. It is said that, by our thoughts, we cause certain things to occur and others not to occur. I hope to be able to show how we are collectively creating a patriarchal reality, which is actually biopathic, harmful to life. And I propose that we dismantle that reality. Our values and the self-fulfilling interpretations of life that we make because of them are creating a harmful illusion which leads us to act and to organize society in harmful ways. This is one sense in which our thoughts do make things happen. If we understand what we are doing, however, patriarchal reality can be changed. First, we must have the courage to change the basic assumptions which serve as fail-safes to keep deep systemic changes from occurring. Although male domination exists in many or perhaps most cultures, it is towards the domination of the white male that I want to direct my attention. In fact, I believe that many patterns of domination and submission have come together to create a pattern of domination for that group at all levels. By this, I do not mean that every white male dominates, or that only white males dominate, but that the patterns of sex, race, and class fit together effectively to allow and encourage white males to dominate in many areas of life. The patterns of domination propagate themselves and the values upon which they are based. In the history of Europe, the rise of capitalism and technology, the slaughter of the witches, the invasion of the Americas and the genocide of indigenous peoples, the slavery of Africans and the Nazi Holocaust are all extreme moments of a culture in which sex, race, and class work together like a giant mechanism to overprivilege some and underprivilege many others. Unfortunately, this mechanism often sets the standard and validates similar behavior in other cultures. Dictators throughout the world climb the stairs erected before them by their European brothers, perpetrating horrors. At present, white males are still the most successful purveyors of patriarchy. Through mechanisms such as the free market, they continue to dominate the global economy. It is therefore the responsibility of their caregivers, especially white women, together with white women's allies among women and men of color and white men, to turn against patriarchy and dismantle it from within. We must all cease rewarding biopathic behaviors and systems. Women and men must stop nurturing patriarchy. Capitalism has had advantages for many women, especially white women, in that it has allowed us to take on the structural position which had formerly been reserved for men. Becoming part of the workforce and becoming educated for positions of authority have allowed many women to acquire the voice, the ability to speak out and to define situations, which is very difficult for women who have only access to traditional family roles where males have all the authority. Many women are using their freedom to speak against the system which, quote, liberated them regarding its many defects, which weigh upon them personally through low wages, lack of child care, and the continued privileging of males. They also condemn the system's exploitation of their sisters and their sisters' children in the so-called third world, here and abroad, its enormous waste of resources through the arms business and war, and its endemic devastation of the environment. I think that all women in capitalism are in a particularly good position to see through its apparent advantages, because we are still being educated to bring up children at the same time we are being encouraged to climb the economic ladder. The contradictions involved in the values which accompany these two mandates draw our attention to the deep contradictions in the system itself. Therapies and drugs of various kinds tend to try to make us adjust by concentrating on ourselves as the cause of our discomfort. However, many feminists are turning outwards against the biopathic system. We are not using the violent methods of the system, but are looking for other ways to change it from within. I believe we have not yet succeeded because we do not realize that we have a common perspective and that the problems we are facing are systemic. By showing the links among different aspects of patriarchy, and by uncovering and asserting our common alternative values, women can begin to dismantle patriarchy, to recreate reality, and to lead everyone back from the brink of disaster to peace for all. The gift paradigm. There is a fundamental paradigm with widespread and far-reaching effects which is not being noticed. It may seem strange. In the time of space travel, computers, and genetic engineering, that anything really important could be ignored. However, we may remember the idea of the elephant in the living room talked about by Alcoholics Anonymous. People who are in denial of someone's alcoholism do not mention it. In order to maintain the status quo, they turn their attention to other things. I believe there is a large part of life that is being denied and ignored. Unlike alcoholism, it is the healthy, normal way of being, but we are indeed turning our attention away from it in order to maintain a false reality, the patriarchal status quo. I call this unseen part of life the gift paradigm. It is a way of constructing and interpreting reality that derives from mothering, and is therefore woman-based, at least as long as women are the ones doing most of the mothering. The gift paradigm emphasizes the importance of giving to satisfy needs. It is need-oriented rather than profit-oriented. Free gift-giving to needs, what in mothering we would call nurturing or caring work, is often not counted and may remain invisible in our society or seem uninformative because it is qualitatively based rather than quantitatively based. However, giving to needs creates bonds between givers and receivers. recognizing someone's need and acting to satisfy it convinces the giver of the existence of the other, while receiving something from someone else that satisfies a need proves the existence of the other to the receiver. Needs change and are modified by the ways they are satisfied. Tastes develop, new needs arise. As they grow, children need to become independent, and mothers can also satisfy that need by refraining from satisfying some of the children's other needs. Opposed to gift-giving is exchange, which is giving in order to receive. Here, calculation and measurement are necessary, and an equation must be established between the products. In exchange, there is a logical movement which is ego-oriented rather than other-oriented. The giver uses the satisfaction of the other's needs as a means to the satisfaction of her own need. Ironically, what we call economics is based on exchange, while gift-giving is relegated to the home, though the word economics originally meant care of the household. In capitalism, the exchange paradigm reigns unquestioned and is the mainstay of patriarchal reality. Even many of those who wish to challenge capitalism envision only an economy without money, a barter economy, which is, of course, still based on exchange. I believe they misplace the dividing line between the paradigms, making money the responsible factor rather than exchange, so they cannot clearly see the alternative that gift-giving presents. Aiding the maintenance of the status quo and the exchange economy is a view of human nature as egotistical and competitive, qualities which are required and enhanced by capitalism. The qualities required and enhanced by mothering are other orientation, kindness, and creativity. Though they are necessary for bringing up young children, these qualities are made difficult, even self-sacrificial, by the scarcity for the many, which is often the consequence of the exchange economy. They are considered not human nature, not part of reality. I believe that the gift paradigm is present everywhere in our lives, though we have become used to not seeing it. Exchange, with its requirement for measurement, is much more visible. However, even our greeting, "How are you?" is a way of asking, "What are your needs?" Communication is giving gifts, from the Latin munus, gift, together. That is how we form the community. By satisfying the needs of the infants who are dependent upon them, mothers actually form the bodies of the people who are and live together in the community. They also care for and maintain the implements, houses, and locations where the community interactions take place. We communicate with each other through our gifts of goods, through communication. Each gift carries with it something of the thought process and values of the giver and affirms the value of the receiver. In fact, goods and services that are freely given to satisfy needs give value to the receiver by implication. And I'm reading from For Giving by Genevieve Vaughn. Exchange, on the other hand, is self-reflecting. It requires attention to be concentrated on equivalence between the products, and the value that might have been given to the other person instead returns to the giver in satisfaction of her own need. In exchange, the satisfaction of the need of the other is only a means to the satisfaction of one's own need. When everyone is doing this, the communication that occurs is altered and only succeeds in creating a group of isolated, unbonded, independent egos, not a community. In their isolation, these egos tend to develop new artificial needs for nurturing and bonding, and use domination to procure for themselves a sense of community and identity they lack, forcing others to nurture them. They use everything from personal violence to manipulation of abstract systems to achieve the satisfaction of their needs, satisfaction which they are no longer receiving from participating directly in gift interactions. In fact, we might look at our society as starving for free gifts and the bonds that are created by them. Our compassion is blocked, and it appears that only by denying giving and receiving can we survive. Yet not giving is killing those who could give, just as surely as not receiving is killing those who have the material needs. In order to maintain this aberrant situation, laws have been established and armed forces are paid to back them up. Huge amounts of money are spent nurturing the justice system, the government, the police, and the military, thereby creating the scarcity which makes gift-giving difficult and exchange necessary as a survival mechanism. Abstract systems of laws and hierarchical organizations like the government and the military are delivery systems for gifts, taking them away from the needs of the many in the community and directing them toward the needs of special groups of exchangers who have been socialized with an ego hungry to have more. While we may be grateful to the exchangers, entrepreneurs, for creating jobs, we should realize that the jobs are a way of getting for the entrepreneur what Karl Marx called surplus value, what we would call a free gift of labor time given by the worker. In order to survive, the worker also has to receive many free gifts from his or her nurturers. Gifts are distributed from the bottom up in the hierarchy, from the poor to the rich, from gift givers to exchangers, while it looks as if the flow is going in the other direction. The interaction of exchange itself has seemed so natural that it would not require investigation. However, it is actually artificial, deriving from a misuse of communication. If we no longer consider exchange natural, or one of the mainstays of reality, we can stop considering our participation in it as a criterion of our worth. In fact, many women have believed that the purpose of our liberation has been to allow us to participate more fully in society. In the U.S., this society is capitalist patriarchy. Women have also felt discomfort in it because our values are different, and at times this keeps us from being successful. The answer to our problem is not to change ourselves to adapt to the bigger patriarchal picture, but to change the bigger picture to adapt to women's values. This change requires asserting those values as more viable than the values of patriarchy. We must understand and deeply criticize patriarchy so we can realize we already have the alternative in our hands. Rather than attempting to achieve the respect of those who have succeeded in the system, we need to stand our ground outside the system. Even respect has to do with looking again, evaluating and being equal to, which are criteria deriving from exchange, and are important only when caring is not already considered the norm. As we shift our focus towards validating the gift paradigm and seeing the defects of the exchange paradigm, many things acquire a different appearance. Patriarchal capitalism, which seemed to be the source of our good, is revealed as a parasitic system, where those above are nurtured by the free gifts of their hosts below. Profit is a free gift given to the exchanger by the other participants in the market and those who nurture them. Scarcity is necessary for the functioning of the system of exchange and is not just an unfortunate result of human inadequacy and natural calamity. And I'm reading from Forgiving by Genevieve Vaughn. Language and Giving. Since we use language throughout our daily lives, and much of our thought takes place in language, it seems obvious that it would have a strong effect on us, not only as a process or instrument, but as a model. Language also has the power of having come from others, from the many, It is a deep connection that we have with other people in our society. It is an important part of our socialization as children. The fact that all human societies have language does not have to imply that language is genetically based. There is something else that all societies have in common, the caregiving done by mothers. This social constant does not depend so much upon the biological nature of mothers as upon that of children who are born completely dependent. If someone does not take care of their needs, they will suffer and die. The satisfaction of their needs must also take place without exchange, because infants cannot give back an equivalent of what they receive. Their caregivers are thus forced into what we might call a kind of functional altruism. Society usually interprets the biological abilities of women, such as pregnancy, birthing, and lactation, to assign the role of mother and caregiver to women. Girls are brought up with the values that allow them to act in the other-oriented ways necessary for that role. If we look at communication as the material nurturing or free gift-giving that forms the community, we can see the nurturing that women do as the basis of the community of the family unit. The nuclear family, especially the relation between mother and children, is just a vestige of what a community based on widespread gift-giving may have been at some time in the past, or could become in the future. The isolation of pockets of community from each other keeps the gift model weak, while the scarcity in which most of us are forced to live makes gift-giving difficult, even self-sacrificial, and therefore unrealistic. While material nurturing is made difficult by scarcity, there is one thing of which we have an unlimited abundance, for which almost all of us possess the means of production. That unlimited supply is language, with which we are able to produce ever new sentences. Our vocabularies are finite, though almost infinitely recombinable. We receive words and sentences free from other people and give them to others without payment. Language functions as a sort of free gift economy. We do not recognize it as such because we do not validate gift-giving in our economic lives, and in fact, we usually recognize the existence of nurturing specifically only in the mother-child relation. It therefore does not occur to us to use gift-giving as a term of comparison for language. With language, we create the human bonds that we have stopped creating through material communication. Language gives us an experience of nurturing each other in abundance, which we no longer have, or do not yet have, on the material plane. This idea has led me to think that if language is what made humans evolve, perhaps it is the gift-giving in abundance aspect, not the abstract system, that made the difference. If we were able to reinstate a material gift-giving community, perhaps we would evolve again, as New Agers and many others hope. In fact, I believe that it is the exchange economy itself that is impeding our evolution. The logic of mothering requires that the nurturer give attention to the needs of the other person. The reward for this behavior is the well-being of the other. There are many different kinds of needs, and it is sometimes a challenge to understand and provide for them. Giving and receiving in an ongoing way creates expectations and rewards, a knowledge of the other and of the good that satisfies a need, commitment to further caring, and an expectation that it will occur, an ongoing relationship. Each participant is somewhat altered by the experience. Even when material goods are not available or not being used, a need for bonding with the other person may still arise. I would call this a communicative need, a need to bond, a need for the relationship. Words are the social verbal items that have been devised to satisfy communicative needs. Since we use words to satisfy communicative needs regarding something, we consider words as gifts. The mother first nurtures her child with goods and services, but she also nurtures her with words. The child is actually able to participate in turn-taking with the mother, verbally giving her communicative gifts before she is able to give her material gifts. And I'm reading from Forgiving by Genevieve Vaughn. Words as gifts. A question arises here about the materiality of the verbal gift. Although we can identify a word as a repeatable sound unit, and it shares this character with other words, it can only be used for satisfying communicative needs, not for satisfying material needs directly. The word bread does not satisfy the need to eat. However, communicative needs can sometimes be indirectly functional to the satisfaction of material needs. For example, there is bread in the cupboard can be seen as a service that helps someone to satisfy her material need for bread. Saying the word bread as a request satisfies the listener's need to know what we want. We could consider the lexicon as a collection of gifts satisfying different communicative needs. Each word is a sequence of phonemes, a program of vocal behaviors which may be identified by the communicative need or needs it satisfies. Boiling an egg is a sequence of behaviors having to do with various material objects, which satisfies the need to eat a cooked egg. Saying the word egg is a series of vocal behaviors which satisfies a communicative need, establishing a relation with others. Whether we should consider word gifts as goods or as services is something like the question whether light is made up of particles or waves. The kinds of communicative needs the word gifts satisfy have proliferated to make use of them, much as the eye and the visual cortex have developed on our planet to make use of the light. It is useful to consider the materiality of words as somewhere between goods and services, because the gifts on the nonverbal plane which they represent may also be of varying degrees of materiality. From Loving to the Color Green, from the Moon to Capitalism, all kinds of nonverbal things are represented by verbal things, creating verbal communication and the formation of linguistic and sometimes material communities. Just as material gift-giving and receiving of goods forms the physical bodies of the people in the community, verbal gift-giving and receiving contributes to their formation as social subjects with psychological identities. And I'm reading from Forgiving by Genevieve Vaughn. Is reciprocity exchange or turn-taking? Homo economicus, the protagonist of neoclassical economics, is made in the image of exchange. Even the word homo, meaning the same, brings with it the idea of an equation. We educate our boys to be similar units of masculinity and then to vie with one another for economic and symbolic superiority. We educate our girls to nurture this process and to bring up their children in its image. This has the effect that in the, quote, free market society, more males can be found in the practice of exchange, while more females can still be found practicing gift-giving. Our economic systems are based on exchange, and our study of them, economics, is based on exchange as well. Capitalism itself practices the values of masculinity, and masculinity the values of capitalism. Since these are social roles, they can also be practiced by persons of the other biological sex. However, this may be rendered more difficult because the social interpretation of genders creates many impediments against the success of one gender in areas usually occupied by the other. One of these areas is economics, the academic discipline that studies capitalism. Because the study of the production and distribution of goods in our society is based upon and directed toward self-validating exchange, it does not consider gift-giving as economic. Yet gift-giving is indeed the production and distribution of goods. The microeconomics of a different gift-based macroeconomic system takes place in every household. Women's unmonetized gift labor has been invisible to economists until recently, because those who were practicing the values of exchange were the only ones studying it. Now, some women economists who, like other women, have been socialized towards mothering and the practices of gift-giving are applying gift values to the study of exchange and to their profession and are experiencing a great deal of healthy cognitive dissonance. However, they have not yet begun to question the validity of the exchange paradigm itself as a worldview, perhaps because they are still more or less successfully operating within it. It's easier for those who are at least partly outside the exchange logic to identify and promote gift-giving as a socially relevant paradigm, indeed as a solution to the problems being caused by exchange. This revolutionary vanguard would include not only women, housewives, and mothers, whether or not they do monetize labor, but all those who do not make profit from exchange and instead are unconsciously giving to it, the male and female hosts of the parasite. Most of us are still blinded to gift-giving by the internalization of the self-reflecting logic of exchange. Even while we're practicing it, we do not recognize gift-giving, think about it at a meta-level, or have a meta-language with which to talk about it. We continue to think in exchange terms about our own culture, as well as about the examples of institutionalized gift-giving in other cultures. A recent school of thought in France, based upon the work of the anthropologist Marcel Mauss, devotes a great deal of attention to gift-giving, which it sees as composed of three moments: giving, receiving, and giving back. The insistence upon reciprocity hides the communicative character of simple giving and receiving without reciprocity and does not allow this group to make a clear distinction between gift-giving and exchange as two opposing paradigms. It seems to them that gift-giving is just a variation on exchange, with a longer payback time and less emphasis upon equality. The bonds still seem to be caused by constrained reciprocity rather than by the direct satisfaction of needs. Like most men, these investigators are limited in their thinking because they have not been socialized toward the adult experience of creating bonds directly through mothering. Gift-giving appears to be a curiosity, not the mother-based mammalian life logic or a program for social change. Years ago, French anthropologist Lévi-Strauss's description of the symbolic exchange of women among family groups inspired much further speculation in the exchange mode by anthropologists, psychoanalysts, linguists, and semioticians. From the gift paradigm point of view, women are themselves the source of nurturing, so that the giving of women is a gift of givers, a meta-gift. The exchange, if it is constrained and seen through our capitalistic eyes, or turn-taking if it is not, has a content which, in the case discussed by Lévi-Strauss, is women who are the source of giving. Giving and receiving, rather than the constraint of reciprocity, is what causes bonding. The interaction of nurturing and receiving nurture, or nurturers, is the mutually creative factor. Not the imposition and following of the law, not the equivalence of exchange, nor the constraint of reciprocities. In societies which are less deeply etched by exchange than our own, gift practices, gift cycles, serve definitional purposes, defining relationships among members of the group. We might consider them descendants of language, of another lineage than exchange, by using the giving and receiving gifts, co-communication, for the purposes of status. And I'm reading from For Giving by Genevieve Vaughan. Women are the vanguard. Lewis Hyde, Jerry Martien, and other writers on gift exchange have done work which reinterprets historical and anthropological literature, at least partially liberating the idea of the gift from the constraints of capitalism. Perhaps because they have not had the experience of mothering, they tend to see the gift way as a poetic thing of the past, which has been forgotten, marginalized, and covered over, much as their own experience of the gift way with their mothers when they were children has been covered over but still remains in the unconscious and in myths and stories. Continuing to see gift-giving in terms of reciprocity, that is, exchange, maintains the discourse within the parameters of the patriarchal status quo. Women can more easily recognize the presence of gift-giving everywhere because we have an actual example of it in our adult practices of our social role, however socially disqualified and valued that may be. That is why women are the vanguard, the carriers of gift-giving as a social program, a way of organizing society now and for the future. The lack of a theory of language as gift-giving makes the understanding of gift-giving as a living principle more difficult. However, the discussion of money as a gift and wampum as words and speech acts proposed by Martien is a bridge between language and material gift-giving, as was wampum itself. Martien lets us see that wampum was a means of material communication, interpreted by European settlers only as a, quote, primitive kind of money. The strings of shell beads were sent from place to place to define situations and satisfy special needs for bonding, attention, and care. For example, special beads were sent to those in mourning to satisfy their need for consolation. Beads were given to create pacts and maintain promises among social groups. Wampum would appear to be a many-word material language which went beyond definition to create solidarity and mutual inclusion, while money remains at that stage which names everything quantitatively in order to facilitate a more, quote, primitive human relation of mutual exclusion, of having and not having private property. In our own lives, as well as in the investigation of other cultures, the question arises as to whether it is possible to follow and assert a clear model of gift-giving or whether by focusing on giving back, any transaction becomes assimilated to the model of exchange. This is really a problem of the intersection of two logics, but it is often read as a moral question. We ask, is she really being altruistic? Or is this just a hidden manipulation, which only clouds the picture and sometimes makes us pay for our acts of love with shame? We wryly comment, no good deed ever goes unpunished. Self-interest appears to be the basic motivation of all humans, with scarcity as its natural complement. The good of the whole seems to be, after Adam Smith, the compendium of the self-interests of all, while orientation toward the other is unrealistic and self-sacrificial. Reciprocity is a way of maintaining the self-interest of both parties to the interaction. The custom of giving back a bit extra, more than one has received, is a way of reaffirming the gift model, even when, through reciprocity, one is running the risk of being perceived as exchanging. However, this process has also been assimilated into exchange as interest on loans. In fact, lenders give their money in expectation of the extra gift of interest they will receive. This kind of exchange has become so much the norm that an interestless loan is now considered a gift. And I'm reading from For Giving by Genevieve Vaughn. Anthropologists, like the rest of us in patriarchy, have difficulty taking off the mirror glasses of the exchange paradigm. Thus, they talk about gift exchange, confusing two modes from the beginning. Again, gift giving appears to be an underdeveloped version of exchange, rather than a different and more viable method of organizing society. In so-called primitive societies, gift-giving often has a symbolic function. I believe that is because, in imitation of language, as we just saw with wampum, special material substitute gifts, like verbal substitute gifts, are given in organized ways for the purpose of creating specific bonds among givers and receivers. In other words, both the exchange of commodities for money and symbolic gift exchanges are variations on the theme of communication. There are two alternative uses of the intertwined patterns. In fact, both language and the production and distribution of material goods are found in all societies and have coexisted for millennia. Societies have learned to use their own processes in a variety of ways to create new processes of communication. Language is a second verbal gift economy, while definition and naming are special decontextualized processes of language. These processes evolve into exchange when they are transposed onto the material plane, as people substitute one product for another and equate them quantitatively. The introduction of money provides a general equivalent, a single substitute gift like a word, in which the values of all the products on the market can be expressed and evaluated. While money provides an additional abstract element in the exchange process, it does not alter its basic logic. Thus, barter is not a solution to the problems caused by exchange. Rather, it is only an example of the same logic without money. By taking the distinction between gift-giving and exchange as the watershed between two basic paradigms of human interaction, we can clarify a number of different, seemingly unrelated problems. Many gifts. We can understand many of the irrational and harmful aspects of patriarchal capitalism as a point of contact between the two paradigms. Surplus labor, that portion of the worker's labor time that is unpaid and goes toward the profit of the capitalist, can be considered as a gift under constraint from the worker to the capitalist. The tendency to pay women less than men for comparable labor can be interpreted as an attempt to maintain women in a gift-giving position, reinforcing our practice of the invisible gift model by making us give even more unpaid gift labor than our male co-workers do. Because of the equality of exchange and the value we attribute give to it, we are apt to give credit to the market as just, even when it is penalizing us. Father knows best. Women's unpaid labor in the home has been calculated as some 40% of the gross national product. It is one of the most glaring examples of unrecognized gift labor that exists. Consider also the gifts that come to the rich from the poor, to the north from the south, to the exchange-based economies from economies that are still to some extent gift-based. Differences in exchange rates, levels of life and self-sufficiency in the, quote, developing countries permit a flow of gifts from them to the so-called developed countries. Not only is this flow not recognized as such, but it is actually read in the opposite direction, so that the North appears to be giving loans, material aid, information, technology, markets, protection, even a civilizing influence to the South, which becomes depleted and crippled, trying to pay back the more, the interest on what has been given, but which has actually served to stimulate more hidden gifts which drain away its capital. For example, lowering the level of life in the third world countries serves the first world by lowering the price of labor, transforming the differential of low-cost labor and raw materials into collective gifts from the many in the South, through the few in the South, to the few in the North. The manipulative use of gift-giving for the purpose of profit-making, leveraging more gifts, is in itself an exchange. However, misinterpreting gift-giving as an exchange and profit as deserved confuses the two paradigms and is not just a bias of academicians. It is a very widespread view that is part of and supports the practice of exploitation. The many examples of actual slavery that have poisoned human history are evidence of the tendency to place groups of people in constrained gift-giving positions through owning them. Women of all races and cultures have also often been in these positions with regard to their husbands, whether or not they were actually owned. In order to accumulate capital, surplus gifts must come from somewhere. Slavery provided that surplus free to the slave owners in the south of the U.S., for example, though it cost immense human suffering to the slaves. But exchange also provides an efficient mechanism for accumulation. By hiding the gifts it receives behind the screen of an equation which appears to be fair and a transaction which appears to come from a free choice, no matter that the absence of alternatives often reduces poor people to a situation similar to slavery. Capital can be seen as the combined gifts of the many captured by exchange and understood within exchange's self-reflecting parameters as coming from fair profit on an investment. Equal exchange does not produce a profit. Gift labor is necessary for that purpose. Gift labor is easy to hide because, as we said regarding language, giving is transitive. If A gives to B and B gives to C, then A gives to C. Thus, if a wife gives her free labor to her husband and he gives his surplus labor to the capitalist, the wife's labor passes transitively through her husband to the capitalist. The gift is also unseen because we avert our gaze from the original source. At most, we look at B giving to C. What is in full evidence, however, is the so-called equal exchange between B and C, where the capitalist pays the worker a salary which is determined by the price of that kind of labor on the market. Focusing on the salary as the just price of labor draws our attention away from the quantifiable and unquantifiable gift-giving which is also taking place. Exchange validates itself and fits with the other exchanges which are occurring in the market. It floats like a cluster of bubbles on a sea of hidden gifts given by women, workers, the unpaid, the underpaid, the poor, the unemployed, who with their demand for jobs keep the just price of labor low, and all those in classes and countries which are in a gift-giving stance toward privileged classes and countries. Then there are the many gifts of consumers who consistently overpay for products like gasoline, which have a relatively low production cost, but a high utility to people whose needs have been determined by transportation industries. There are the gifts of the past, of the surplus value contained in fixed capital, but also in mostly women's free gifts of maintenance of the buildings, goods, use values, and people of previous generations, their children, their language, their art, their culture, and the byproducts of their lives. There is a great unrecognized flow-through of gifts from the past to the present as well, as for people in groups and in countries in the giving stance to the countries in the taking stance. There are the gifts of nature ready for our use, air and water and sunlight, which we are adapted by evolution to creatively receive, but which are becoming polluted and scarcified by being covertly expended, wasted, to cut the costs, give gifts, in the service of the exchange paradigm. This pollution forces unborn generations to hand over to us their potential use of nature's gifts so that we can make a quick profit. We are blocking the flow of gifts towards the future. New types of commerce invade previously gift-giving areas, from fast food restaurants to laundromats. The inheritance of all is becoming commercialized by the industry of biogenetics, turning even the biological free gifts of the many to the profit of the few. And I've been reading from Forgiving by Genevieve Vaughn, first published in 1997. You can find out more about Genevieve Vaughn's writings and work at gift-economy.com. And you can download this and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests for free as a gift at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guests, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.